If you could find a moment like that during the week, going from the literal level of viewing to the symbolic, to the deeper emotional, ecstatic level of seeing. Cher, did you have such a moment of vision? Yes, the waterfalls up in Ithaca. I think we may need to... David, I'm sorry, can I impose on you just to throw that switch at the back there? We've got a little bit of interference from the... Thank you.
That's better.
Sure. Nice.
All of
beautiful.
These things were happening at the same time, and I think they, the feeling that they gave the ancestors, plus I did a painting of this waterfall, not knowing it, 20 years ago, I did a painting, and I saw this image in a book on New York Ancestors, and I did it, and I had, didn't register where it was or anything like that, or the name, and when we got, when you see the waterfall, you're kind of peeking around the bend, and you look, and the, all this, there's trees, and then you can see a little bit of water beyond the tree, and then you can hear the power. So it's like slowly revealing itself to you. And once I saw it, I was like, wow, I painted this waterfall 20 years ago.
I think that qualifies as a,
yeah.
It's one of those deeper moments of seeing things. That's a good one. Go around the room and just say your name.
Well, I have a similar moment.
Oh, please. Well, say your name first for us.
My name is Christine. I had a very challenging week, and I just got back from California adjusting, and then all of these emotions started coming up, and then we had this traumatizing experience in yoga with this woman who had a seizure, and I was just coming down from headstand, and I was so in the moment, and, you know, I see her, and it was like, everything was so slow, and I see her eyes, and it was so penetrating and strong. But I realized that I couldn't get that image off my head, and then after that, I let all those emotions from everything that was happening, and they just weighed me down, and just like, I was so sad, and I got really like depressed from just everything that happened. And I think it was a mild shock that I had a conversation with Rodney. And I didn't even tell him what was going on with me. He was just talking about living in the moment. And just all these other things. And I'm like thinking, with life, when we allow these little things to pile up and pile up, they just become so heavy. And we put those in our yoga stance. And we can't do it. I feel like it becomes harder to do yoga. And it becomes harder to live in the moment the more that we carry this extra baggage. And all of a sudden I realized that, but I don't know if I'm being clear about what I'm saying, but
no,
as soon as I dropped everything and I was really just conscious about living in that moment, literally everything became clear. Like, I didn't just see a man. I saw more like the vibration of the man, the colors were just deeper and stronger. And just more.
Yeah, it's a real roller coaster ride, isn't it?
All of the week.
You can have a moment like Cher had, you know, of this overwhelming sense of beauty and majesty, you know, in nature. And then a moment like you had, where, you know, you're seeing someone go into a seizure and the heavy emotions that set in. So, and it can happen in the space of moments, can't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Going from one minute you're in a state of exaltation, you know, over something so beautiful that's finally come through, and then boom, the phone rings and you're right back down there. Right back there.
Yeah.
It's really something. Really something. Therefore, there's always a therefore. Samatvam yoga uchyate. The Bhagavad Gita says your yoga practice is meant to help you find that samma, that place, that middle road, that path of equanimity, where you're not feeling the catapult of exaltation or the depth of despair, where you're able to absorb those experiences as equal. We kind of like the happy times, you know. Those other times, we don't really particularly like them. The yogi, according to Bhagavad Gita, is able to see that both have a place in the scheme of my life. That's to be coveted, that kind of a position, isn't it? Where you can come back as you did quickly. I used to watch my spiritual master, and you know, this was someone who at a very advanced age had come and taken responsibility for thousands of people all over the world. He'd taken responsibility for their spiritual life. You know, when the guru accepts to award initiation to a shishya, to a disciple, at that moment there is an agreement that the spiritual master will absorb your karma. The spiritual master takes responsibility for your liberation. And if you don't complete the yoga path in this lifetime, then that person comes back voluntarily to be with you in your next birth, in your next life. That's a very, very heavy commitment. And the commitment on the other side, it's not a one-way street here, the commitment on the part of the disciple is, I will take this practice very seriously. I will follow these principles very seriously. I will dedicate this lifetime to following the teachings as I have received them from you. So here was someone in his 70s who, you know, was taking so much responsibility from so many, and sometimes he would get sick, physically sick. A spiritual master, someone who assumes that much karma of the disciples, especially if there are many of them, that can manifest as sickness, as disease. So he would sometimes, you know, be overwhelmed with having assumed so much responsibility. And yet his spirit was never diminished or compromised. He was always in that place where he was sama. Samatvam yoga uchyate. He had reached that place. It was very inspiring to see it. Really. Everybody else doing okay? How are you doing, Andrew? How was your week?
Incredible.
That's quite an answer.
Well, today I booked my train ticket online to go from New Delhi to Haridwar in India.
Oh my gosh.
And
when do you leave for India?
November 15th.
Wow, fantastic. Wonderful, wonderful.
And I tried to get the details to do that. Election and a lot of people gave up and it seemed impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But I worked for all the viewers.
You managed to do it. Good for you. That's an accomplishment.
Who is against technology.
Right.
I manipulated the
you managed somehow anyway.
Cyberspace.
Yeah. Don't you feel a real victory when you get through it?
Yeah.
Well, that'll be a wonderful trip.
Yeah,
no
you.
Doubt. No doubt. How is everyone else doing? Hi. How are you? Any other moments of either symbolic or rasic vision this past week? David? Yeah? What was your moment?
Unconsciously, and I was not thinking of the homework assignment.
Okay.
And, but had occasion to attend a wedding on Sunday of my next door neighbor growing up. And she was kind of like the late incarnation of the love of her parents, as they could not conceive until much later. It just worked out that way. So as I was 17 and she was born, I never knew her. But at her wedding, her mother, who's no longer with us, was so present and so there in everything, in all that existed. The sun, the nature, the ocean, the people, the spirit in the air. It was too real, too tangible, not to be appreciated by men. And for me, it was a dynamic kind of over and over. Oh, yeah, And it was all quite peaceful, all beautiful anyway. But to see it in that way was a dramatic...
Well, there were several things there. First of all, the power of the passage of time. Someone whom you were 17 when this person was born, now she's getting married. So to actually see the physical change there from infancy to now womanhood and those transitions. And the mother's presence as well.
The bride was the mother. She was, without question, the manifestation of Francie's love and full-on personality and spirit. She was there.
Yeah, it's amazing. Amazing. Thank you. Thank you. Beautiful. I suppose the point being that if our eyes are open, everything can bring that kind of a deeper vision. It doesn't always have to be something quite that startling or that dramatic as a waterfall or seeing a young woman's mother present in her person. It can be something very, very simple. This time of year, I'm always reminded of that because when I walk outside the door of my house, there are these two trees that have grown together. And one is a small split maple and the other is a tall evergreen. And the split maple is compromised by growing in the shade of this very big evergreen tree. And so it hasn't grown very tall. It's rather small. And I asked the groundskeeper, there's someone who comes to do the lawn, and so I say, can we separate these two trees? Maybe we can transplant the maple so that it has more exposure to the sun. And his answer was very revealing. He said, you know, these two are so intertwined that if you tried to separate them, one of them would die. And boy, I was thinking of Radha and Krishna and how they're so inseparable that if you tried to separate them, it would be like death. So just seeing a tree can sometimes offer that same kind of moment or inspiration, especially this time, you know, the change of seasons, very dramatic time. So let's just go around the room, say hello. Andrew, you've said hello already. You're up.
Amitai.
Good to have you back. Thank you. David?
I'm David.
Yes, you are.
Julie.
Mira. Hi.
April.
Oh, may I mention that if anyone has access to an industrial kitchen, is that it? Please
sure.
Let April know.
Her amazing vegan.
Yes, her vegan cookie business is doing very well and needs...
Wow.
More kitchen capacity. So if anyone has a lead, please just let April know.
Yeah.
How have you been, Leela?
Good.
Good to see you. You're up.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm great.
Welcome, welcome. What's your name?
Omar Escanaha.
Omar, welcome.
Thank you.
Hi. And this is Howard. Howard is a friend from Jaya Yoga in Brooklyn. And you were here once before when there was a substitute speaker. Right?
So, yeah.
So,
nice
to have you here with us.
Very much.
You want to introduce yourself? How's it going?
Very well.
All right, good. Cher, everyone knows Cher. She's our choreographer and chief set designer. You want to introduce yourself again?
Christine.
Hello. Goodness, this is old timers week here. Nice to have you back.
Thank you.
This is Nahama. And we were just going around the room introducing ourselves anyway, so you're right on schedule.
I'm Robert.
How are you doing, Robert?
I'm good, thanks.
Welcome. We're in the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and we're reading text number 7. This is in the chapter titled Karma Yoga. We're still early enough on in the drama of the Gita that Krishna is still relating to Arjuna in a rather basic way. We haven't yet come to that place where the level of their conversation has gotten so intimate that everything else disappears. And that does happen later on, where they start talking about more esoteric realms of devotion on a battlefield. And I'm always imagining what it's like for these hundreds of thousands of warriors, you know, dressed to the hilt, you know, with, you know, armor and weaponry, and they've got their horses and chariots and elephants, you know, and the conch shells are blowing, and, you know, it's like, this is going to be a battle to the finish. And they're kind of, you know, drumming their fingers on the side of the chariot wheel while these two are going at it. And their conversation is getting deeper and deeper. They're getting all excited and talking about all these marvelous things. Meanwhile, the whole battle has just disappeared for them. They're in Savikalpa Samadhi. You know, they're just, this, everything else has disappeared. And they're right there just for each other talking. But we're not there yet. We're still in only the fifth chapter of the Gita. And here is Arjuna still hesitant for many reasons. And Krishna trying to bring him out of that hesitancy. Trying to bring him out of that state of... He's catatonic. He's reached a place where he can't do anything. He's hit a wall. He's so bewildered by the enormity of what he has to do, that the systems have just shut down, and he's reached a place where he finally just turns to Krishna and says, "Shishasteham sadivam tvam papannam." He says, "Let's change the nature of our relationship. We're friends. We've known each other all our life. Okay, let's put that aside. I'm asking you to be my teacher now, and I want to be your disciple. So let's just set aside the fact that we're related by marriage, that we've known each other since we were kids. Let's talk now as teacher and disciple, because I need your help." That's a critical moment right there, to be able to acknowledge, I need help. That you don't have to be, you know, the macho, you know, American pioneer, you know, the spirit of independence and self-reliance. We're going to do it ourselves. You know, that it's okay to say, I need help with this. In fact, that's a great moment to come to be able to say, this is worth doing, and I'm not sure how to do it. Can you help me? You are not diminished by asking for help. You are elevated. That ability to say, I recognize my limitations, is a marvelous, marvelous place. In the eighth chapter of the Gita, there's an entire list of qualities of enlightenment. The very first one is humility. The very first one is an ability to say, I don't know. I'm not sure what to do at this point. Right. So here's the Sanskrit. We can chant this together. Um, We'll use a different melody today. So please repeat after me the invocation. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. The reason why we begin with that invocation is that this is not a class in, you know, biology or mathematics. It's a exploration of a sacred text, and there is some formality involved, just as there's formality that transfers food from being material to being a part of your spiritual life by the offering of a prayer. You don't have to be in a temple with the full altar ceremony for the offering to be to transform from material to spiritual. All that it takes is a little heartfelt sincerity. That before you begin to eat, before you, in devotional terms, respect the prasadam of God, before you are honoring sacred foods, you take a breath. You know, that's your yoga 101. Take a breath. What does that breath do? It slows your metabolic rate down. It brings oxygen into the brain. Gives you a moment to reflect that I'm not eating. I'm performing another kind of yoga. Prabhupada used to call it kitchen yoga. That we're eating our way back to Godhead, you know. Just by eating, you can realize God. So if you take that moment to recognize this is not just food that I stuff. The idea of fast food is just so antithetical to everything. Eating, standing up, and, you know, multitasking while you're eating. Just the rest of the world will be there when you've finished the meal. Just sit quietly and commune with that food for a moment. And well, it's a big difference. Really, very big, very healthy thing to do. So a little bit of formality, and especially when we enter into a discussion of the Bhagavad Gita, we start with that invocation. Okay, so now the Sanskrit, there are four lines here, and the melody that we usually use is this one. That's in a major mode, so this will be in a minor mode. Try that first line with me. Yoga yukto vishuddhatma vijitatma jitendriyaha vijitatma jitendriyaha sarvabhutatma bhutatma sarvabhutatma bhutatma purvanapi nalipyate purvanapi nalipyate yoga yukto vishuddhatma yoga yukto vishuddhatma vijitatma jitendriyaha vijitatma jitendriyaha sarvabhutatma bhutatma sarvabhutatma bhutatma purvanapi nalipyate purvanapi nalipyate. Now there you only have two notes. So if you can't remember the other melody, which is a little more complicated, you can use that simpler. Would anyone like to try chanting the verse? Go ahead, David.
Yoga yukto vishuddhatma bhutatma purvanapi na
Well done. Anyone else? Okay, Sharon, go for it.
Yoga Yukta Vishuddhatma Vijitatma Jitendriya Sarva Bhutatma Bhutatma
Well done. All right, here are the synonyms. Yoga yukta, engaged in devotional service. Vishuddha atma, a purified soul. Vijita atma, self-controlled. Jita indriya, having conquered the senses. Sarvabhuta, to all living entities. Atma bhuta atma, compassionate. Kurvannapi, although engaged in work, na, never, lipyate, is entangled. Translation, one who works in devotion, who is a pure soul, and who controls his mind and senses, is dear to everyone, and everyone is dear to him. Though always working, such a man is never entangled. Here's the purport on page 236. One who is on the path of liberation by Krishna consciousness, which is the term that Srila Prabhupada would use to describe bhakti yoga, or the yoga of devotion. One who is on the path of liberation by Krishna consciousness is very dear to every living being, and every living being is dear to him. This is due to his Krishna consciousness. Such a person cannot think of any living being as separate from Krishna, just as leaves and branches of a tree are not separate from the tree. He knows very well that by pouring water on the root of the tree, the water will be distributed to all the leaves and branches. Or by supplying food to the stomach, the energy is automatically distributed throughout the body. Because one who works in Krishna consciousness is servant to all, he is very dear to everyone. And because everyone is satisfied by his work, he is pure in consciousness. Because he is pure in consciousness, his mind is completely controlled. And because his mind is controlled, his senses are also controlled. Because his mind is always fixed on Krishna, there is no chance of his being deviated from Krishna. Nor is there a chance that he will engage his senses in matters other than the service of the Lord. He does not like to hear anything except topics relating to Krishna. He does not like to eat anything which is not offered to Krishna. And he does not wish to go anywhere if Krishna is not involved. Therefore, his senses are controlled. A man of controlled senses cannot be offensive to anyone. One may ask, why then was Arjuna offensive in battle to others? Wasn't he in Krishna consciousness? Arjuna was only superficially offensive because, as has already been explained in the second chapter, all the assembled persons on the battlefield would continue to live individually as the soul cannot be slain. So, spiritually, no one was killed on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Only their dresses were changed by the order of Krishna, who is personally present. Therefore, Arjuna, while fighting on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, was not really fighting at all. He was simply carrying out the orders of Krishna in full Krishna consciousness. Such a person is never entangled in the reactions of work. I read the full purport here, even though every sentence needs a little unpacking. We've talked about this before, that Prabhupada's language is sometimes reflective of his moment in history. You know, he was born in the 19th century, not just the 20th, he was born in the 19th century. And into British colonial India. And even the use of the word Lord, for example, in describing Krishna as Lord Krishna, that's a convention that's brought over from British colonial language. You know, a Lord was an elevated person in, you know, the British administration, or the British aristocracy. So to give the divinity the title of Lord was a way of saying, you know what, Hindus, you don't have to convert to Christianity. We have our own lords. We have our own aristocracy. There's no need for you to go there. So some of the language is reflective of those cultural conventions. But let's go back to the translation just for a moment. One who works in devotion, who is a pure soul, and who controls his mind and senses, is dear to everyone, and everyone is dear to him. Though always working, such a man is never entangled. That's another, if you will, linguistic idiosyncrasy, is that Prabhupada uses somewhat sexist language. It's always he or a man is. I knew him. He was not sexist. It may be there on the printed page, but in his behavior he was quite the equal opportunity guru. And there was never any discrimination or favoritism. Yoga Yukta, engaged in devotion. That's right there. That's already revolutionary. The idea that yoga means devotion. The deepest meaning of yoga is love of God. Pure and simple. Full stop. Full stop. You want to read it in Sharon and David's book, it's there. It's here in Bhagavad Gita. Without love of God, your yoga has some benefit, but it is not the full benefit of your yoga practice. It's that simple. Yoga brings you to that place which is the deepest core self. And what is that deepest core self? It's a spark of God. The energy that animates this body with consciousness is pure spiritual Shakti. There are two categories. There's Vishnu Tattva or Shakti and Jiva Tattva. Vishnu Tattva means the avatars, the incarnations, those beings who come from that privileged realm of the Supreme, the God either in person or embodied in the form of an avatar coming into the world. All other souls, which means all of us here, we are from the category of Jiva Shakti or Jiva Tattva, meaning infinitesimal sparks of that great Vishnu Tattva divinity. We are of the same quality, but in minute quantity. As God is fully self-aware, so we are also, in our modest little way, capable of full self-awareness. As God is full of knowledge and wisdom, so we are also capable of becoming full of knowledge and wisdom. As God is eternal, so we are also eternal. As Krishna is by nature blissful, ananda, so each of us is by nature blissful. That's our true nature. Why are we more inclined toward finding happy, enjoyable situations, and why do we do everything we can to avoid uncomfortable, unpleasant, painful, sad situations? It's because discomfort and pain are not natural for us. We seek our own original nature, and that original nature is joyful. And as Krishna is a person, so we too are individual beings. We never lose our personhood. We are people not just in this embodied state, where you're a person and you're a person and I'm a person, but after liberation as well, you retain individuality. And that's the depth, the true root of all yoga practice, is to come to that place of recognizing the individuality of self and the relationship of love that binds the individual jiva soul to the individual supreme soul. Example is often given a drop of water, which is of the same chemical composition as the vast ocean, but small in quantity. So the verse describes someone who has reached that place of understanding, that I am an eternal divine being. Knowing it is different from realizing it, of course. Just being aware of that intellectually is not the same thing as walking your talk, of having come to a place where you understand that so thoroughly that your every gesture, your every word, your every thought springs from that place of devotion to God. That's an amazing place to be. That's extraordinary. And if you It's, of course, not exclusive to the Vaishnava tradition, to the Bhakti tradition of Bhagavad Gita. Read the esoteric texts from any wisdom tradition, you will find that same place where the great souls are walking through this world transcendental to it. The Native Americans would describe it as casting no shadow and leaving no footprint. I think I've mentioned to you before this extraordinary book by Evelyn Underhill called simply Mysticism, written in 1904. Still one of the finest books on mystic experience that you can read. And she took whatever information was available at the time and compiled this extraordinary collection of stories of the tzaddikim, I guess. Is that the plural of tzaddik? Is tzaddikim? You know, the enlightened beings in the Jewish faith, the Christian mystics, the Sufis, the Hindu rishis. And she took whatever information she had and wrote this extraordinary book. And there are certain patterns that pretty much repeat across cultures. One of them is what we were talking about a moment ago, samatvam, you know, where you reach a place where you are not disturbed. It's described that as this is in Bhagavad Gita, that as the ocean is not disturbed by the constant inflow of water from rivers. So many rivers empty into the ocean. The ocean is always calm, never disturbed by that flow of rivers. That's the example given in the Gita. So the enlightened person who knows himself or herself to be the eternal soul within this temporary mechanical vehicle. In the Gita, the body is called a yantra, Yantra. Yantra means a machine. It's an extraordinary machine. It's an amazing machine. But it's a machine. The driver of this machine, that is you. That is the soul within the body. You've been in other bodies before. This may be your last lifetime. This may be your last body. Say goodbye to it now. Perfecting your devotion as a regular daily practice. How do you do that? How do you get to that place? How do you get there, you know? And what's it like when you get there? What's it like to be, you know, a tzaddik? What's it like to be an enlightened soul, you know? Well, from, huh?
You're free.
You're free, exactly right. You're free. There is nothing that binds you anymore to the world. Why? Because you have no self-centered desire to fulfill. The Sanskrit is paradukkha-dukkhi. Paradukkha-dukkhi. The only disturbance for the enlightened being is seeing others distressed. That's the only upset in the life of an enlightened being, is that other people are not there. And other people are still subject to the ups and downs of that merry-go-round of experiences in the world. So, yes?
You know, you just said that, and you talked about being enlightened and having your, for instance, you're an enlightened being, and you
can find a better example,
no,
but go ahead.
So, somebody's an enlightened being, and you have your disciple, and you, this is your last life. You just talked about your last incarnation. However, if you see an individual and you feel like you really want to reach out for this person, like there's a soul, like a very, you just said right now that the only downfall of being enlightened is that you see people that are not enlightened. So what if you have this really connection with this individual and you wanted to have them enlightened, but you know that they're going to reincarnate? So can you choose as an enlightened being to go through another incarnation to help them along their path?
Well, yes. I mean, I think what you're describing in the Buddhist tradition would be called bodhisattva. It's someone who delays his own entrance into nirvana in order to stay in the world and to help others. And that's a very, very, very advanced position, a very, very advanced place where voluntarily, instead of going back to Godhead, back to Krishna, back to the spiritual world, back to that eternal realm, you choose instead to stay here because your empathy, your compassion for people who have not yet had that grace of the door opening to their deeper self are still suffering. That's an amazing place to be. It's not for everybody. It's nice to aspire to that, but jumping up to that kind of a level too quickly can be dangerous. You have to remember, first of all, you have to be so spiritually grounded and so aware of yourself and so removed from your own subconscious psychic needs that what you're doing is truly selfless compassion. Very often, in the name of that kind of a gesture, we're acting out something of our own on a subconscious level. I mean, the most obvious example would be a sexual relationship where, you know, for a moment, as you were describing reaching out to someone, I'm saying, yeah, how many times do people reach out and what they're really doing in the name of something quite, you know, noble is just kind of wanting to get together.
But not only that, also like the companion, the love that a mother has for their children, that kind of love.
That's about as close to selfless love as you can find in this world. The love, it does exist, yes. And the love of now we're talking about healthy, non-neurotic families, okay? We have to qualify every one of these examples. There's no such thing as all mothers love their children selflessly. It doesn't have, unfortunately, it's not the case. There was something in the news today about a Native American child. Did you hear this news report? Where the child had been put up for adoption. And then the father used law that says that a Native American child cannot be denied that child's cultural heritage to regain custody of that child. And then the child was awarded by another court back to the adoptive parents, and you got the child going back and forth like this. So we have to qualify by saying parents who are themselves grounded, perhaps with a depth of spiritual awareness, who are able to convey love without all of the usual psychic baggage that goes with it, you know, that's the love that probably comes closest to spiritual love. You don't love your child ideally because that child's going to take care of you when you're old. You know? You love that child because you're my child. That's all. I love you. I look at my son and his wife taking care of their daughter who cannot even really reciprocate the way a normal child can reciprocate with all the stuff that she's saddled with. And yet the love between them is absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. So that's about as close as it gets in this world. Now, Alexander.
In Master Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, there's actually a sutra towards the middle to, I don't know, three-thirds through the first chapter on samadhi about what you were talking about, you know, bodhisattvas that do choose to come back to reincarnate, do choose to, you know, have that seed, again, the karmic seed that brings them back in for the purpose of that, you know, to help others.
Yeah. Honestly, from my own experience, and I'm talking now as someone who lived 13 years in ashrams and temples, if you want to do that, if you want to reach out to someone, check it out with some other people. We get into trouble when we act on our own initiative and we think we're acting from noble motives, and we can get into all kinds of complicated situation. The value of having this, and this is what the yoga community is meant to be. It's sangha. It's meant to be sangha. I hope sometime to see more people from other classes coming for these discussions, because that's what half of your yoga is, the sangha. It's the company of people whom you can trust with your deeper feelings, to whom you can confide when there's something that you feel compelled to do but you're not quite sure, and who will be there to help you. I mean, there's no reason why we wouldn't help one another here. It's like family, right? So you need a kitchen, you know, for your cookies, or, you know, you need some advice on photography or whatever it may be, you know, bring it. You know, bring it when you come here. We'll have a chance to talk about it.
I also think that the script that you read about having to detach from your desires, it's very goes side to side with it. You know, when I'm not looking for, in my sense, is to satisfy anything, but just to purely help you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the ideal. That's the ideal. But why? The question is why. Now here's where we have to make a very important distinction between reaching out compassionately as a sentimental gesture and reaching out compassionately because you've understood the ontological foundation of relationships with other living beings. Two very, very different things. It's the sentimental kind of selfless gesture that gets us into trouble. That's where the ego creeps in. If you're reaching out because you understand, this is part of my yoga practice. Why should I love this person? Because like me, this person is a soul conditioned by so many repeated births and deaths in this world, struggling as I am struggling with the body and the senses and the mind and the intellect and all of the baggage that comes with that. So I see something of myself in this person, and we have a connection. We're family. We are all parts and parcels of the Supreme Being. We are all spirit souls, sparks of God, sparks of Krishna. Therefore, I reach out to you. I reach out to you because I am compelled by my very being to reach out to you. So study, 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 study. You cannot enter into a real understanding of yoga, a real understanding of devotion, a real understanding of yourself as an eternal being different from your body and mind if you do not study. Read this book. Don't wait to come here on Tuesdays. Read the Bhagavad Gita. You should be coming to class with all kinds of questions. Hey, Yogeshwar, I was reading chapter 97 last week. You know? In which case, I want to see which edition of the Gita you're reading. And there was this verse that I don't get it. I don't understand. That's the kind of energy that, you know, okay, I'm kind of spilling my cards here. I'm telegraphing something to you. I normally don't do that. I'm going to do it today. Right? You're going to get extra brownie points, an extra vegan cookie, right? If you come to class with questions. Come to class with something that you've read on your own initiative that you don't quite understand or that you'd like to discuss. Now we've got a class going. How many times do you think I really want to see myself sitting up here yakking away like there's nobody else in the room? Bring it to class. Bring it here. This is so exciting. We can be having discussions every minute of every day on this stuff. It's so exciting. So what's going on here? What's going on is that Arjuna is reaching out to Krishna and saying, help me. Help me. I'm stuck here and I don't know what to do. And Krishna's answer in this particular verse to Arjuna, his response to Arjuna, is relax about it. You're so worried about the consequences of really giving yourself over to a yoga life that you're your own worst enemy here. You can relax about it. It's okay. You're not going to get a bad rep. You're not going to lose your street cred. You're not going to all of a sudden become an outcast. It's okay. Why? Because when you come to this place of being a pure soul, mind and senses controlled. Control doesn't mean, you know, you've tightened the belt and tightened the screws and you're just in utter agony. That's not what control of senses means. control of the senses and mind means you've given them higher engagement. This is described in Bhagavad Gita as param drishtva. Param drishtva nivartate. Param drishtva nivartate. I'm trying to remember the rest of the verse. Krishna says that you, the embodied being, which is us here, can be restricted, can be controlled, can be moderated in the life of the senses by engaging them in a higher taste. Param drishtavi means a higher taste. I remember as a kid, I used to love Tchaikovsky. Boom, boom, da 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 da, boom, boom. You know, just yeah. You know, they're the firecrackers. I should get them. You know, it was like that was real classical music for me. You know, as I got a little older, you know, I started, you know, a little Bach, a little Beethoven, a little Mozart. Why? Because as I grew, my thought processes became a little bit more mature, and the greater challenge of that intellectual depth of composition appealed to me more than the fireworks stuff. I didn't have to wean myself painfully off of Tchaikovsky. The other emerges naturally if you give yourself the higher engagement. So, but you have to do that. You have to give yourself that opportunity to engage in something higher. So practically, what are we talking about? Read the Bhagavad Gita. Find some good ideas. Come to class with that. Go to a museum. Expose yourself to art. Go to a poetry reading. You know, allow yourself the privilege of taking advantage of being a New Yorker to enhance your experiences. But don't just go for the sake of having the experience. This is the point. This is the yogic perspective. You do that in order to challenge yourself to see, as we were discussing last week, on that rasic level, where you're going beyond the surface, beyond the literal, to the symbolic, and deeper than the symbolic, the rasic, that spiritually emotional platform where everything becomes an impetus for ecstatic love. Yeah, Nakama.
So, this sounds to me like, you know, if I were to walk into a museum and walk around and look, I would not see, you know, what somebody with a more refined eye would see. And when I go into a restaurant or to a wine tasting, I don't have the refined palate that, you know, a real gourmet might have. Mm-hmm. And so, to increase your depth of understanding, or do something with a docent, and you maybe do a tasting where somebody describes the subtlety of flavor that you're not picking up on. Mm-hmm. Is that the role of the guru?
Ooh, interesting analogy. Is the guru like your tour guide through the Museum of Life? Yeah, that's not bad. That's not bad. When you go to a museum and you don't have the benefit of the background, you look at a painting, you look at, you know, Picasso's Guernica or something, and, you know, well, that's interesting composition. But you don't understand, you know, that this is born out of the pain and suffering of war. And if you get that additional historic background, isn't your appreciation so much more enhanced? Sure, absolutely. Or listening to a piece of music. If you know something about the composer, the time that this was created, what the impetus was, the significance at that time, your appreciation, your enjoyment of it is enhanced so much more. Absolutely. Well, you don't have to read the whole thing. Even one verse, one page, anything at all. The idea being to do just what you're pointing at, which is permit yourself to not live life on automatic pilot. Permit yourself the privilege of going inside every experience of your day to finding that spark of divinity that is there within every atom of life. It's there in the Brahma Samhita. Andantarastam paramanu chayantarastam govindam aripurusham tamaham bhajami. Ah. God is there within the atom and between the atoms. present in every molecule of existence. But we just don't really give ourselves an opportunity often enough to think about that. Well, that's what yoga is for. Yoga is meant to make you thoughtful about everything. So, wonderful, wonderful analogy. Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah. Other thoughts, other ideas.
What you said, I mean, I agree, but wouldn't it be, like, I think when you tie logic to every single thing, like, you have to have logic, I think it's a sense of control. In a way, it's like, you have to know why. It's when you just enjoy the moment and it's what it's bringing you.
My mom was a jazz pianist. And I remember watching her rehearse her scales. And I used to be confused. Why? She's so good. I mean, she can, like, go all over the piano, right? Why is she doing scales? Because you master the bass. Before you can improvise, before you can be so adept at your, whatever your particular endeavor is, that you can do what you're saying, which is to just kind of be in it and be able to go to the depth of understanding how great it is. There's a requirement that, again, is bred from that humility that is the very foundation of spiritual life, which says, I don't know enough yet to be a great improvisationalist jazz performer. Let me practice my scales. Let me get some depth of knowledge. And then when that becomes second nature to me, then I can go into what I'm doing with that spontaneity, because that spontaneity will be grounded in knowledge and wisdom. So it's not mechanical in the sense that you're describing, just logically piecing things out. It's permitting yourself the great privilege of going deeper inside the experience by learning about what goes into it. Then you can go and do it spontaneously later. That's described as vaidhi bhakti, or devotion in practice, which leads to raganuga bhakti, spontaneous devotion. We all start with the practice. You know, like, who was it was giving the basics class here before we started? Yeah, you start with the basics. And I love coming back to basics class. I think that's a wonderful place to be, you know, because I'm always doing everything wrong. I'm not, you know, the hardest pose for me is it's like just an mountain pose, you know? Just standing, knowing how to stand well, you know, it's really something. So,
yeah, that seems like sometimes, you know, like our longings are not answered if we have longing for, you know, spiritual experience. We are there.
Connect that with what we're discussing. I'm not sure I see the connection.
Because, like, you can have the practice, you can have the learning, you can go to the museums, but sometimes you're not going to see what you want to see, or is that going to happen for you?
Well, you know, good things take time.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, we've been in this world a long, long time. So many births we've gone through. We never underestimate the depth of our conditioning. We're so deeply, deeply conditioned. I think sometimes we lose track of that because we're kind of acclimated by the culture that we're in for, you know, fast. We want results. No, I want it now. Give me now. And if I can't have it now, I'm going to go to someone else and get it now.
Yeah, like before class, someone asked me, for $1. You know, he didn't ask for $1. So I want a Jefferson. And so I was reaching for my wallet. He said, I want a Jefferson, like $100. And I didn't have a Jefferson for it. I just had $1. So he said, oh, it's a George. I was very disappointed. I don't want to see George. It's a George. So I said, okay. But that's what it's. And he asked me, where is Jefferson? I said, he's dead. Jefferson's dead. And I kind of dashed his hopes, too. Because Jefferson is still alive, I just don't have $1 bills. I don't carry $100 bills.
Well, so yeah, so we can get disappointed.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to watch Jefferson. We all want to be it. We all want that Jefferson.
But we can't always necessarily have what we want. Or as those great sages of the 60s tell us, you can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, David, would your hand up?
No.
Okay.
There's a talk I heard that Ram Dass was giving, and I mean, I've heard him say this several times, but it just puts a smile on my face every time I hear him say it. He goes, "So you don't get what you want? How interesting! How interesting! You don't get what you want." I'm like, "Okay, I'll try to look at it that way, like, instead of being like, but I want it, I want it." And he's like, "Oh, isn't that interesting? I'm not getting what I want." Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Sometimes, though, it's tragic, because what we want may not be something childish or frivolous or foolish. Maybe what we want is for someone to not have to suffer. Or maybe what we want is that we shouldn't destroy the earth. You know, or maybe that what we want is something that really should, by all rights, occur, and it doesn't occur, and we can't help but feel that deeply if we're thinking, feeling people. I don't think there's anything wrong, you know, in having deep bad feelings. There's nothing unspiritual about that. It's not. That image of a spiritual person as being above emotion, I think, is miscast. Someone who's had deep realization is someone, if anything, they feel deeper about what's going on in the world. So it's not a moving away from emotion. I think it's an ability to know how much of that emotion is healthy and useful because it's an impetus to action, and how much begins to kind of weigh us down. I think that's probably part of an enlightened frame of mind. Yeah, Nicole?
Well, I think that feeling emotion deeply, if it's coming from a place of recognizing that divinity in the other being that's suffering is coming, again, from that same realization, mm-hmm. how could you not feel it deeply then? Yeah. Whether it's a positive or a negative, why wouldn't you reflect that emotion if you're recognizing that in the other?
Yeah, that's quite true. And maybe the mistake that sometimes gets made is that people expect that if they reach a point in their practice, they won't have to feel that pain anymore. That I will now be exempt from that. When actually, what Krishna is evoking in the Bhagavad Gita is a willingness to become comfortable with discomfort, to make your peace with the fact that in this world there will never be that place of utter and total samatva. It doesn't happen. I want to read a letter, if I may. I brought this just in case. This is a letter from a Bhagavad Gita student. It was a businessman a few years back. And it was there. I just picked it up. And it's apropos, so I'm going to read it. This person wrote, it was in an email. We were having a conversation about his family situation. He writes, "I just cannot bring myself to abandon my son by putting him through the university life, etc., and leaving him to the damage of market forces. How can I live with sending him out into this crazy world and always be thinking that I failed to find some other more meaningful way to prepare him for life? On the other hand, there's so much underlying radical ideology in the Bhagavad Gita right from the very beginning. What is, quote, 'you are not this body,' end quote, but a call to radically switch off to the material world and all that it entails? I can't begin to tell you how conflicted this makes me. Work Ethic America and real yoga practice are at opposite ends. Work Ethic says we should value service over our own liberation. But in yoga, there's so much nostalgia for renunciation and a life of asanas and bhajan that it's hard not to see how others aren't feeling what I'm feeling right now. This is so bloody annoying, he writes. I think of China and the reaction that Confucians must have had to the arrival of the Buddhists, who had a similar antisocial or pessimistic view of the world. There is a level of toughness. This is his conclusion. He says, there is a level of toughness that you need to accomplish anything in life. You often hear about the ability to say no in time management seminars. I have never had that capacity. And it has been my ruination. Spiritual life is to a great extent about self-definition. One, you know who you are. Two, you know what you want. Three, you figure out how to get there. And four, you keep your focus and don't allow any distractions. And if you don't follow that sequence, especially step four, you end up mired in the trough of despondency, which is where I am now, sending you this letter. Isn't that something? Now, I'm not saying I agree with everything that this person says here, but his concerns are absolutely legitimate. Absolutely legitimate. There is no ultimate reconciliation between what we're trying to do, namely be yogis in New York City. What are we thinking? You know, the very thing that we're trying to do, you know, we walk outside the door and the fire gets stoked. Absolutely. The illusion is thinking that if I do that, if I follow that noble calling to be there for others, somehow I'm going to become calmer, more peaceful. You go into the fire, be prepared for the heat. You want to do that, that's great. You want to be a, you know, an urban yogi. You want to go out there and do your, you know, spiritual activism. That's where it's at. That's what's happening here. Arjuna is like saying, I want to go to the woods. You know, I want to go to the forest. Yeah. Krishna's saying, don't do it. You stick it out. Because this is here's your forest. Here's your place of meditation. Right here on the battlefield. He's telling him to do it. But he's not handing him some propaganda that if you do this, somehow it's going to become easier or that you're not going to feel it anymore. The proof of that is that at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, at the end of the Battle of Kurukshetra, Arjuna and his brothers had won the battle. They had won the war. And they lived the rest of their lives in utter despair. Yudhishthira, who was the oldest and the one who was installed on the throne, lived with the guilt to the day he died that so many people were killed just so that I should sit on this throne. And he never got over that. And the dynasty ended up killing itself off in a fratricidal conflict. And they were unable to stave off the beginning of the Kali Yuga. The Kali Yuga still started right after the Battle of Kurukshetra. So it's not that you go into this yoga practice because someone is offering you some kind of panacea against the ills of the world. It's that you're able to do that and survive it. That's the difference. And maybe if we... practice our scales long enough, we'll reach a point where we can do that, where we can then spontaneously be out there doing our thing and not being as affected by it. That's not something that's going to happen right away. You've got to work for that. So study, 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 and continue your yoga and just keep going, keep going. Eventually, it will happen. Eventually, Krishna reveals himself. By dint of your sincerity, by dint of that constant dedication to your practice and to the study, yoga without the philosophy is sentiment. It's sentimental. And the philosophy without yoga is simply theory. The two are parallel tracks, and you must have both. Yeah, say your name again.
Omar.
Omar, hi.
According to Gabriel Cousins, I may not be familiar with him. According to him, it all comes down to grace at the end of the day. Talking about, you were saying, it all comes down to grace. Is, you know, it's not when we want it, it's when a higher power. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's where the deep breathing comes in. Really useful. Because you can't command grace to happen when you want it.
Yeah, can't get lucky.
You keep going. You just keep going with your practice. We prepare ourselves so that grace has some place to come to. Without that, grace is not the lottery. You know, you buy a ticket and you take your chances. We have to prepare. We're preparing ourselves. What is the chanting on the beads? What is the chanting of Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare? It's cleansing the heart. It's preparing a place where God can appear. Can we do arti?
No.
Who's doing? Oh, who's, is someone doing arti? Someone scheduled to do it? You're doing it? Scheduled? Okay.
She's scheduled. She's very
pretty. Okay. Yeah.
You know, I'm
sorry, Rodney.